When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
Let's go.
Guys, welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. I'm Jeff Fader. I'm here with the main man, Ben Camon of Camon Knives. Before we get into it, let's take care of a little business. First things first, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This is a grinder for knife makers, knife enthusiasts, for metal workers, for sculptors. If you're removing material, this is for you. Go to BroadbeckIronworks.com, put in the promo code Knife Talk 10, you're going to get 10% off everything, grinders, attachments, parts. It's awesome. Definitely worth the trip, without question. BroadbeckIronworks.com. Thank you. Next are my friends at Even Heat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. Definitely check out the tap controlled solid state drive. The dedicated temper oven. There's nothing better. Nothing better. If you're heat treating knives, this is the machine for you. Kiln for you. Many thanks to my friends at Even Heat. I want to thank my friends at Maritime Knife Supply for all your knife-making needs, belts, brazers, steels, kiln, forges, pressing, heat-treating ovens, anvils, and whatever you need to get started or resupplied, including the Hex 1080 Hex if you're forging integrals and you want a wild start. This is the one for you. Go to Maritime Knife Supply and check out what they have. You're in Canada. See if there's something you think he should have. Lawrence will get you squared away. I highly suggest getting the yellow Norton Razor Star 36 grit belts. Just try them. And if you get a 10-pack of abrasive belts, you get 10% off on those abrasive belts. So definitely check out what's going on with them. I love Lawrence and what he does for the knife-making community, so definitely check out MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. I want to thank my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the Stabler Knife Finishing Vise. Their vices are built in the heart of Texas, and they're designed to take your handle finishing to a whole new level with features you won't find anywhere else. So go to TrojanHorseForge.com, put in the promo code FULLBLAST10 for 10% off everything, and I believe they have free shipping. It's the best vice on the market. That's it, period. Thing is awesome. Hand sanding for hand finishing your handles, the best. I want to thank my friends at Baker Forge. It's BakerForge.com, Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram. If you want to get some of that razzle dazzle steel, you want to get your special exotic steels, your copper mascus, your copper mize, your sand mize, your bronze mize, this is the one for you. They hold your hand the whole way. And if you go to BakerForge.com, put in the promo code FULLBLAST, you get 10% off everything. And it's easy to work with, and it's easy to use, and it's easy to finish. And if you're going to finish it, you know what you're going to use. Yeah, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to use Gator Piss. GatorPiss. Gator short for alligator, piss short for urine. This is the best etching on the planet. I love it, and I swear by it. I use it for everything. And I'm surprised how good it works. And you can get it at BakerForge.com, or you can get it at my friends at Texas Farrier Supply. Texas Farrier Supply is a great place in Texas that sells knife-making stuff, blacksmithing stuff, bladesmithing stuff, hand, sand, paper, all that stuff, whatever you need. If you're a farrier, if you're a blacksmith, you want to get it, go to TexasFarrierSupply.com, and you can use the promo code KNIFETALK10 for 10% off everything at Texas Farrier Supply. The guys are awesome over there, and they'll take good care of you. I want to thank my friend. Oh, by the way, that's where I get my rhino wet. When I get my rhino wet, I get it at Texas Farrier Supply because they have all the different sizes, the different grits. It's really, really great. Many thanks to Texas Ferry Supply. Many thanks to Baker Forge. Next, I want to thank my friends at Total Boat, totalboat.com/fullblast for all your adhesive paints, primers, polishing compounds. I love their two-part epoxy. I've been using it for years now, and I've had great experiences. It is a marine grade epoxy. So if that means something to you, it's going to keep your boat afloat and it's going to keep your knife scale squared away. So use your Total Boat for all your epoxy needs. I have lots of friends who are using Total Boat for different products, like Keith Decent, Derek from Alden, Keith Johnson, Keith Mitchell, Jimmy DiResta. They're all using Total Boat. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast, and you can even use, you can go to wherever you're listening to this, and then you can use the hyperlink. And then what that does is it gives me a street cred and gives you a discount. So definitely check it out. And if you're doing the hybrid handle material, get yourself some of that Fathom Thick Set. You will thank me. I want to thank my good friends at GL Hansen & Sons at g.l._Hansen & Sons for G-Carta. I love, love, love. They just sent me some more G-Carta. And it's really amazing. And it's basically, imagine a loaf of, they're making a loaf of G-Carta, which is similar to micarta. So it's fabrics and epoxy mixed under pressure and heat. And they make different shapes and forms and colors. And, you know, and then when it's hardened, they cut off slices. And those slices just look amazing. And the colors are amazing. And they're great for knife handle scales. I've been using them for a long time. I love the Bofa Ripple Cut Tuxini. I like the Mahi Mahi. I love the Colorama and the Hoopla. They have amazing colors, and then they're going to give you some razzle dazzle for your handle material. And Greg is awesome, and I am totally on board with anything he wants, anything he does. I'm getting some more of that stuff because I love it. So go to gcarta.bigcartel.com and get yourself some of that G-Carta. Get that handle scale squared away. And I want to thank my friends at Tormek. I had a nice little conversation with the guys at Tormek, celebrating 50 years in business with the Black TH Sharpening System, Tormek.com, or Tormek_sharpening on Instagram. It's a great company, and they take great care of their employees, but they take better care of their customers. It's a great machine. They're, like I said, a great company. And if you have any questions, go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, and you can ask them to me, or you can send a message into Tormek, Tormek_sharpening on Instagram. They're very, very helpful. This is a no-brainer. If you're a knife maker, it's great. I love them. I've just made all my knives. I've gotten it down, so they're really great. But if you're a carver and you need to keep your chisel sharp, this thing is sick. It's a sick machine. So go to Tormek and check out what's going on. And I want to thank my friends at Nordic Edge. They're back. Nordic_edge on Instagram, nordicedge.com.au. If you're in Australia and you're looking for a knife making supplies, they're great. I love these guys, and they really are involved when it comes to blacksmithing, leatherworking, spoon carving, all these crafts, which is, it's what they say is other crafts where you get some time to take for yourself and turn an idea into something tangible. Not only do they teach, sell products, but they teach stuff. They have blacksmithing classes, knife making classes, spoon carving classes. You should definitely check out what's going on with them, and they're great. And the people behind them are amazing. I mean, Mertansu, Sausage Man Forge, Bjorn, they're all just top-of-the-line people. And if you're in Australia and you want to feel like there's something going around where somebody's selling some bogus Rhino-Wet, some, like, knockoff Rhino-Wet, you're not going to find that at Nordic Edge. Nordic Edge is going to give you the good stuff. And I want to also say that their file guides are my favorite. They have these screw-on file guides, and I've just been beating the brakes off of them, and they are just lasting forever. I love them. So go to nordicedge.com.au. They have the guidance to accelerate your creativity and the tools, the products, and the supplies to manifest your ideas. Bjorn, that was all me, baby. But it all came from you. I want to thank Nordic Edge for coming back. I love these guys, and all my sponsors are fantastic. But you know who's back, and I couldn't be happier. My friend Ben Camon of Camon Knives is unbelievable. One of the best knife makers in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And don't say anything yet, Ben. Just let me say something. Because I get people in my DM saying, I've been waiting for Ben to come on. He comes, they don't realize, you know, these motherfuckers don't realize that you come on every so often, we fuck around. You might get some, you're going to get some good stuff out of Ben, but you're also going to get some jokes. So get ready. Ben, come on. Happy New Year. How the hell are you?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me. I couldn't be better.
Oh, really? Why is that?
I had a pretty stressful few weeks and put some knives out and I got a new machine and yeah. So
what kind of new machine did you get?
It's a hydraulic screw press.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's super big. I mean, the biggest machine in my shop, big for, you know, knife maker comparison. It weighs 7 tons.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was quite stressful putting it up. The crane had trouble or had issues putting it into my shop. So, but it worked out. It's there now and it was cheap and yeah.
What are you going to use it for?
Mainly forge welding. That's the main purpose. I always wanted such a machine, and now this one is way bigger than I ever intended of buying one, you know, but there was the opportunity. It was cheap, so I had to take it. And maybe since it's so big, I can use it for other things, but yeah, we will see.
Well, see, that's the thing that I don't think a lot of people realize, especially people getting involved with, you know, any kind of craft or kind of hobby. Sometimes bigger is better for a lot of these things, especially you don't want to bottom out on something. You want to grow, be able to grow with stuff. And the way you've figured out a way to make your company much more streamlined and industrial, I believe it comes from your background as a fabricator, a blacksmith fabricator. But this sounds like this is going to be something very new for you and what you guys do.
Yeah, it's new. I mean, I know this kind of machine from other knife makers. Swiss guy, the guy from Apex Ultra, Marco Guldemann, he has one. And he used it for forge welding at pretty low temperatures because those machines, they, you know, hit the material with such high pressure that you can use lower heats to forge weld. So that's, yeah. And I mainly wanted it to have, you know, not only better quality results, but, more consistent results, because with the power hammer, you always run into some issues. The hitting, during forge welding isn't the most ideal way. A press is always better. Now a hydraulic press, it sucks the heat out of the package sometimes, so that's not ideal either. Either way works, you know. Many people use the power hammer or the hydraulic press, but I think the screw press is ideal because it's a middle thing of the two. It's way faster than a hydraulic press, and then quite a bit slower than a power hammer. But it's the right middle thing with a lot of pressure, and yeah, it's pretty cool.
That's interesting. So, see, I think, you know, on Knife Talk, we had a lot of questions of people saying, should I get a press or should I get a hydraulic press or should I get a power hammer? And, you know, the funny thing is they're both totally different. And one of the reasons why they're totally different is, you know, when I talk about this when Pat comes on, or Pat is a, you know, Pat Quinn really knows a lot about power hammers more than hydraulic presses just because he uses them so much. You know, it's two totally different ways in which to work steel. But what's interesting to me is with the hydraulic press, and I have very little experience with hydraulic press at all. The only thing I know is that hydraulic presses have a tendency to be faster heat sinks.
Yeah.
Because the dies are coming down slower and then they're connecting with the steel, and as soon as they connect with the steel, they just start sucking out the heat. Versus a power hammer, you got taps, and you're not sucking the heat out as quickly.
Totally, it's almost like a hardening clamp. I mean, you can sometimes in some videos you can almost see how the surface where the dies touch of the hydraulic press, how they instantly, you know, change colors. So that tells you how fast they suck the heat out of the material.
Yeah.
And I mean, for normal forging, for forging a hammer, that might not be as relevant, depending on the steel you use. But I'm saying, you know, for a hammer steel, they are quite forgiving. But if you're forge welding something and you're sucking the heat out of the cladding, for example, then your core material is at a higher temperature than the cladding material. And then that's never a good thing to have during forge welding.
I don't do a whole lot of forge welding, and a lot of it for me is part of me feels like I still, I mean, I've been forging for almost 20 years, but I feel as though I still need to be better at forging. You know, I worked at a fabrication shop. I didn't do knives until 10 years ago. So yeah. For the first 10 years I was doing, like, you know, ornamental ironwork, kind of dissimilar to what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I felt as though, and the funny thing is I talk about this all the time, and I was at, for like almost 10 years, I was at this Center for Metal Arts. The word Damascus or pattern welded steel or forge, the only time we ever heard forge welding is we were doing some traditional colonial style forge welds for finials.
Okay.
It was a class. I never even heard of Damascus. You know, even 10 years forging, you never heard of it. Didn't even dawn on me. So I don't really have a whole lot of, I guess maybe it's interest. And one of the things about your work that I love is I find that your work is so far more about the forging than it is anything else. Because, like, when I see your work, like, you could take almost any of your work. Let's just take the monolith knife. The monolith knife is what you've done that's just so amazing. And you have a lot of them are mono steel. That's one of the things I love about your work is you do so much with just mono steel. It's not, yeah. You know, you're not using a lot with Sanmai, you're not using as much as you are with mono steel. And to me, when I look at all the aspects of your work, versus whether it's the texture on the blade, sometimes you put on the top of the blade, you put like a kind of, like, I can tell you're hitting some part of the dies on the power hammer to get the specific mark, or just the forging of the your hollowed out monolith handle. It's so far more about the forging than the material itself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the fabricator background, yeah. I guess. I mean, they are real similar. What you said reminded me of a coworker who told me something. He was always complaining about another coworker who was always using too small of a hammer for certain things, right? And smashing things like 100 times instead of using a bigger hammer and smashing it 2 or 3 times. And he told me once, I mean, just, you know, on the go, not really very serious, but somehow it stuck in my mind. He said, you can always use a bigger hammer and compensate and use it for lighter taps, but you can never use a small hammer, a lightweight hammer, for heavy work. Just because what you said with the machines that you, you know, you it's better to have a bigger machine and use it for smaller tasks than the other way around. You know what I'm saying? So
yes,
he had the same thought, but just with a smaller thing, with a hammer. But I think he's totally right.
But when you're referring to hammer, you're referring to a power hammer.
I'm referring to a hand hammer. He said he was complaining about the other colleague because he was making so much noise. He was hitting stuff with a very small hammer so often, and he said, why does this idiot not use a bigger hammer, you know? And then he said, why it makes sense to use a bigger hammer for some things.
Well, this is a very interesting topic of conversation that I have with when Pat Quinn comes on. We're going to have him on sooner rather than later. We're going to do another episode of Great Question with Pat Quinn, where you can send in your blacksmithing questions to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. We'll answer them. This is an interesting topic of conversation because we've had conversations about it. And years ago, I actually asked on Knife Talk, I got like carte blanche with a lot of really great hammer makers and hammer users and blacksmiths on what kind of hammers they use. Yeah. And what I found that some guys use big hammers, some guys use small hammers. And when I talked to Pat Quinn about hammers, what was interesting was, is he says, it's never about the hammer. It's always about the heat maintenance. And he had a guy, there was, without going, getting too, you know, far into it, there was somebody who was, you know, talking about different types of hammers, and he was a younger guy too, and he was just like, you know, you should be using heavier hammers. And Pat and I are like, you know, we've both been through this, you know, we've been through this. And actually, I started out using a 3.5 pound hammer and thought that's just the way it is, and I just got to get my body used to using a heavy hammer.
Yeah.
And as I've gotten older, I want a smaller hammer. But what I'm really spending more time on is the heat maintenance and then using the appropriate tools for the appropriate job.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely, it's, I can see why some people would want to use a bigger hammer. I feel like for the long term, of your life as a physical blacksmith, I tend to say that I would prefer a smaller hammer, and focus on making sure that I'm, you know, as Pat would say, using really good heat maintenance, knowing when to put the steel back in the forge and really kind of optimizing the heat as opposed to, you know, killing yourself with a hammer.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have a few thoughts on that. I mean, I think he's right in the context of you know, working with mild steel. I think there you barely can overheat the material. As soon as you overheat it, it will melt. With knife steels, it's a little bit different because it will be damaged way before it melts. So that's a little different on that end. But generally speaking, I didn't meant to say, you know, go for the bigger hammer. I think you know, that for the most part, I'm using a smaller hammer than when I was younger too. Because, you know, you lose that macho thing almost. And then you get more reasonable and then use a smaller hammer. But I'm thinking of it in the way, if you were to use a half a pound hammer, or like, what is it in kilograms, like a 300 gram hammer, you can hit, you know, as hard as you want, but you won't reach a certain result. Whereas if you use a 3.5 pounds hammer or 1.5 kilograms or whatever, or a heavy hammer, you can always use it slightly, even though it's not as efficient. So that's just what my colleague said. And I think that applied beautifully to those machines, because get the bigger machine and, you know, use it.
Right.
Yeah. But you can't upgrade a weak machine. So I meant it in that way. But you're right with the ladder hammers, totally. Some people will kill themselves with those big hammers.
I've seen, you know, the crazy part is, and a lot of it is based off of, I don't pretend like I know everything. What I do pretend, I do like is kind of learning what different techniques are. It's funny because I saw some farriers years ago, the way they swing their hammers.
Yeah.
And it's madness the way they swing their hammers. It's like there, a lot of them have their elbow. I'm going to have Riley Kirkpatrick on sooner rather than later.
He's
and we're
going to
talk more about, he's awesome. And he's such a great farrier, such a great blacksmith.
Yeah.
And some of the technique you see with a lot of these farriers is their elbow is their arm is not fully extended there. It's almost tight. And it feels as though that they have that long handle, you know, like Ben Snorre's hammers, or the handles are very long.
Yeah.
And they're just like, it's almost more shoulder than it is anything else. And I've seen some kids do it, and I'm just like, I look at them, I'm like, oh my God, this is not, you know, the kind of swinging.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're going to be blasting your life doing. And there's so many different factors to forging and being forging comfortably that I you know, I'm constantly saying, I used to be such a prick about, like, this is the only way to do it. And now I'm just like, look, I saw these farriers, and I'm just like, that's a crazy way to swing. And then I'm like, no, and then they're making it happen. What the fuck do I know? I don't know anything.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not very linear either. It's such a big range. I've got a video sent by some friends of a French scissors maker, and he makes the scissor handle, you know, the part where your finger goes through. He forges it like I do my monoliths, and he uses something like a 3 kilograms hammer that should be like 5 pounds or something like that, super heavy. Wow. He grabs it very far up front, not a long handle, and he forges the whole thing on the horns, and he's like 70. And he forges like a crazy man, and that's what I'm saying. I couldn't do that, even though I'm way younger than him. But he seems to have maintained that even. Because, I mean, he's old. How could he do that? And he was super skillful. I have to send you that video if I can find it.
But yeah, it's definitely super interesting. Send it to me. I'm interested now in forging because, you know, when I first started forging when I was in my 30s and then, you know, working in metalworking, I had a totally different mentality than I do now. Now I want to be able to forge comfortably throughout. I see it all as everything's a marathon.
Yeah.
And I just want to make sure that I can forge into my old age comfortably without worrying about like I was taking some garbage out a couple weeks ago and then there's ice everywhere and I slipped on the ice and I pinched my back. Like I did something to my back and you know, if this was like maybe 15 years ago, I'd have been like, all right, just don't be a pussy and just keep going. And then I was just like, no, this is going to be a real problem in a couple of days. So I rested over the weekend. I didn't do anything and I was supposed to forge this knife out and a spoon and I just pushed it away because I was like, I know that what's going to happen is I'm going to be standing in the shop and I'm going to be, you know, standing on the concrete floor and I'm going to be swinging and it's going to be bad. And I'm glad I waited an extra week because now I forged this stuff out yesterday and I felt pretty good. But at the same time, I was very conscious of just being like, you know, not going balls to the wall and being very cautious because I want to be able to do this through my, as long as I can go. The crazy part is like, I remember seeing Uri Hoffe throughout his life, you know, later in life.
Yeah.
And every time he'd come to the United States, his hammer would be different. When I say it'd be different, he'd make the hammer handle smaller. Like to the point where it was like almost nothing left. I mean, he said, I got to make it smaller because I can't hold it very, very well. And just the way he was working, he was trying to figure out ways in which that he could adjust his technique to getting to the point where he was in his, like, he was in his late 80s when he stopped using a 3-pound hammer, like a mental patient. So, you know, that's the key is like, you know, we're still, you know, you're still a young guy and, you know, how can we figure out ways in which to kind of keep the ball rolling into our older age comfortably?
It's important. I mean, you have to be conscious of that and you have to take measures. That's for sure. But I guess it's very individualistic to each their own. But you should be conscious about it and then you will find a solution one way or the other.
It's like I feel as though also like I didn't wear enough respirators as a younger person. So like, I really just kind of like, I feel as though the damage is probably done. And that's the worst part. Like I really started using respirators for grinding dust and stuff like that, probably about like 10 years ago. And because at the same time it was just like, it was overwhelming. Like the dust was so overwhelming. And I know that when I was a fabricator, I was working with these guys and they were tough guys and everything was like, you know, they wouldn't wear their glasses and they were constantly, you know, every so often you take a guy to the hospital, get steel taken out of his eye. And I was just like, I'm a young guy. I'm not going to have to worry about these things. And now all of a sudden I'm just like, Jesus Christ, what kind of damage did I do?
It's so difficult.
You know, 30 years of working in metal.
Yeah. But it's so difficult in bigger companies because, I mean, for one, there is the macho thing again, I guess, with the colleagues and, you know, wrong pride or whatever. I don't know I don't know if that's necessarily in every company, but then there is the other thing. I know in my company, they were super cheap, so they didn't buy us good gear. So those safety glasses were actually with glass. Those were the old heavy things, barely usable. And other things we just didn't get. I mean, of course we could have, you know, insisted or anything, but then it's sometimes, you know, it hinders your workflow as well. Sometimes depending on the job, you have to be super flexible, you know, go in and out and you're not doing the same things all the time. So you can't really, you know, cover yourself and put the gear on and all that. So yeah, I get it. But I mean, one should definitely wear it. It's the smarter way, but I think sometimes it's difficult, I guess.
Well, the hard part is like experience is underrated and people don't realize it until it's too late, you know. So it's
that
like,
too.
All right, I want to know about I can't wait to hear all about you, this new project you're doing. You do these beautiful new knives with this wild handle, this plastic handle. I don't know if it's plastic handle. Tell me all about this new project you're working on?
Yeah, it's a plastic handle. And the reason for that is I needed a material that can take some forces because the tang is forged to a wedge shape, similar to the shape you have on a hand file. And the handle holds in a similar way. So it holds through static friction. It's just wedged in there. And I burned those tangs in. They are, you know, they have a super nice fit up. It's every handle just fits to its own blade that way. So I had to, you know, number them and mark them out and all that. Yeah, and the knives themselves, Apex Ultra Mono Steel, 60 pieces. I went a little crazy. I learned a bunch of things with that too. For example, that 60 knives aren't necessarily more efficient anymore, at least for the way I work. 30 seem to be a sweet spot for me. 60, I was feeling some pain. You know, straightening those blades cold when they were soft annealed. I had my elbow hurting and during grinding my thumbs started hurting, where I was applying pressure to the blade. So I never encountered any wear on my body to that extent before. So with that big batch, talking about age, you know,
yeah.
I encountered that for the first time, and I didn't really have many benefits from such a big batch. I think I had to heat treat over 2 days, you know, 30 knives per day. Yeah.
That's great.
It went great, but I'm just saying, you know, in the sense of efficiency, it didn't make any sense anymore. So 30 seems to be the limit for me. But yeah, loved the batch. People loved it too. A lot of demand. Sold quick, and they're just arriving with their new homes, or
they're all gone.
Their new homes.
They're all gone.
Yeah. Luckily.
Oh, dude, you're the man. What do you mean luckily? 60. I mean, tell you what, I love that you did this giant batch. And the reason why is because it's regardless of whether or not you say it's worth it or not, it's so good for your mind to go into madness.
Yeah.
Because that's what it is. When you're doing big groups like that, I'll never forget I did this giant sculpture of 60 needlefish carved and painted sculpture. It was fucking madness. And the worst part was the painting, because every paint stroke I would do one, I would do on all 60. So I wanted the painting to look the same. So that was crazy. But what happens is like you learn these, you have to get to the point where you're not going to see results immediately, because you're working on 60 of the same thing every goddamn day and at these different points. And I probably imagine that your work as a fabricator helped you kind of like get over that mental hurdle of doing that project.
I think so. I mean, we talked about that. I think of it as being in a race with yourself. You know, you put yourself a goal in front of you, and then you work towards that goal and kind of challenge yourself like a good friend would do, like, fuck you, you can never do that, but just in your own brain. And then you're saying, well, hold my beer, and you go to work and kind of fuck yourself, but you know what I mean.
Do you think it made you more efficient after the fact? I almost feel like it's exercise, and you've done this giant race, and now little stuff is a lot easier.
I learned a lot. I don't know about that, but I mean, I learned that 60 are just kind of too much for me in an efficiency sense, and I learned that my body doesn't necessarily play with such big batches very well. So the learning experience was there, and I mean, I'm super happy. The content is great as well. You can't forget that. I mean, a picture where you have 60 knives just in one frame, that's nice on its own, you know.
I'm looking at the pictures now. I love the ones where they're on that blue cart and they're all kind of standing up at it. You made those little boxes little holes so you can figure out where all the handles go. And the way that you've burned, you kind of like you heated up the tang and everything like that, the heat mark is all at the same spot on every single one of those knives.
Yeah,
it's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, that I made after the fact, I have to admit. The tang did get some tempering colors from burning it in, but then I over-polished the blade and then I heated up again. So it's kind of, yeah, how do you say, artificially...
All right, all right. In so that sense, but you touched it up. You touched it up.
Yeah,
a little
touched
bit.
It up.
How did you find that plastic? What was the plastic? What was the decision on finding the plastic and making? What was the decision that you were going? Because this is an amazing accomplishment, but you don't normally do this kind of burned in plastic handle.
Yeah. The main goal, the main idea with those knives was how can I, with, you know, all the knowledge I gained over the years and all the fine work I improved on and fit and finish, and how can I use all that knowledge to produce some more affordable knives, because those fucking customs, they got more expensive and more expensive, and not only by themselves, by me raising the price with inflation or such, but just by the extras, you know, every time I made a new, more complex handle shape, I had to calculate that in somehow. But the end result was a more expensive knife. And now I thought somehow I want to have one of those production knives again and make something cheaper. But then the production knives I made before were stock removal. And I thought there has to be a solution to forge a knife and still have it be affordable. And the main thing for me is, or where I put a lot of hours into is the handle. And that's not only the handle itself, but the tang, the fit up, you know, soldering the fret into the end, all that.
Right.
Those are all rather complex steps. And with that forged wedge, it's really as forged, it's not ground at all. And with that burn-in construction, that's how I'm pretty proud of that. And at the same time, when you do that, you need a material that can take the force. So if you would use wood, for example, and burn it in there, it would hold up if you just super slightly tap it. But you know, once you tap it too hard, the wood would just split right on you. Which is why the Japanese have those, you know, horn ferrules horn ferrule on the front of the handle, you know, that ring, to hold it together.
I had no idea that was for.
Yeah, yeah.
I see what you're saying. I don't know anything about it. So the copper that they when they have the wood, they kind of cut out a little bit on the top, and then the copper fits over the sleeve, and then that kind of keeps it from splitting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, copper. Copper. I don't know. With Japanese knives, you have that horn material.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah,
right, that black sleeve almost.
Exactly.
Cover,
but in principle, you know, my idea wasn't anything new. You have that with the cones of your drill presses. You have that with files in every shop. Every shop file has a handle that is not glued in. It's just holding through the wedge shape of the tang, essentially, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now that I think about it, I never even thought about it until you started saying it. It's like all the files I have, they have that plastic handle with like almost like an insert, and then you kind of drive it in and then you give it a tap.
Exactly. So I stole the idea. It isn't anything original in that sense, but of course you have to find the materials you can work with in that framework. And POM, the plastic is called POM. It has some very nice properties. So it has a relatively high melting point, which means it doesn't smear as much on the grinder. It grinds similar to paper micarta. And, you know, resistant against all kinds of acids, oils. It's food safe. So, yeah, just a great material. It's inexpensive, to be honest.
But that's important, is how do you figure out ways in which to pass along some savings to some customers?
Yeah.
That's important. I love I'm watching the video now on how you the instructions on how you remove it from the knife itself.
Yeah.
where you just give it a tap and then you kind of do it to the side of the of the
cutting board.
I love this product. I get a lot of messages asking people, because you know you are very innovative in terms of your handle design. Your handles are always, not only have they been very beautiful, like I know that you've done all those knives where you have the bolt on butt cap and then you have the bolt on you have the bolt on bolster where you have like kind of revealed a lot of the holes so you can see the holes, and you've kind of created a really great design. Your handle design is always really high level, and even though this is so simple, it's very elegant.
I think the elegance comes from the simplicity. I just concentrated on performance. I wanted to make something that doesn't have any drawbacks to my main knives in regards to performance. So you know, steel choice, the forging, the forged taper, and all that, heat treatment, all those things, I always made compromises in the past with those stock removal production knives. And this time I wanted to make something that matches up in regards to performance, but has no bling bling, essentially.
Yeah. Wow. But you know what, though? It still does have that bling bling, because it is, I mean, I'm looking at the video where you're kind of like, your little bit, your sexy video where you're inserting the hot knife into the hole. It's like, your content is so elite. It's so great. I love everything about it.
Thanks.
I know. It's so funny. It's so funny. But I mean, you make everything so approachable.
Yeah, I hope.
Yeah. Good. Good. So do you think you're going to do this type of handle material again, or?
Yeah. I'm very motivated. Smaller batch, but I'm looking forward to doing another one. I don't know when, but at some point in the future. My main customers then have to wait, but I think that's just what it is. I never gave out clear timelines. Just to be honest, within other things, because of that, I wanted to stay somewhat flexible, even with collaborations and stuff like that. I put in between. I never gave out, you know, super clear timelines for my customers.
And the other thing is you've made all these amazing jigs. So all the jig to hold the handle in place while you insert the heated tang in. The jigs are all the R&D is finished. So like for you to be able to do this again, it's gotta be a ton easier.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't have to produce that fucking content anymore to that extent, because that was, maybe some listeners don't, you know, always having a camera around, thinking about what you're going to film and then filming the shot, checking for lighting and all that. It's such a time suck. It's so crazy. And then I'm not even talking about the editing and all that. And I'm, you know, just producing 1 minute reels. It's not even a proper video then, but it's just,
yeah, but you do such a good, I mean, I can tell you do such a, I try to do the least as possible, because at the same time, like I really want to be focusing on the business end and less about the production. The problem is like, I can't not do it. But the fact is like, you know, you spend a lot of time on the video, because I know I can see that the camera, number one, the camera is amazing. The filming is really good. The lighting is really good. The editing is really good. You're speeding this up when it needs to be sped up. And you've just everything about all your videos. I remember when you did that video with Tomer at Florentine Kitchen Knives, where you guys did that collaboration. It was amazing. And you put so much time and energy into it. And it's like, I can tell. I mean, you do way more work than I do. I don't do shit. My last episode, I had Bob from Everyday's Feast Day, and he's been using my knives, and part of me's just like, just use the knife, and I'll all of a sudden just, you know, make me as a collaborator. And all of a sudden, when he posts it up, I'm just like, I don't have to do anything. This is like one less thing I have to do. And I got a real professional chef using my knife. And I'm like, I don't have to do this bullshit paper test. I don't have to do these bullshit fake cutting tests. I don't have to do any of this stuff myself. I got a professional guy using a knife. It's good enough for me. I don't want to do less is more.
No, I'm totally with you. I mean, to be honest, it's I'm making that content to communicate what makes me horny about those knives, you know, what makes me, what gets me going about those knives. And if I don't communicate the freak factor or to the freak that I myself am, then I'm almost thinking about a lost opportunity in those regards. It's almost like those old knife makers who put out ingenious work but don't have a website and don't tell their customer base what went into that knife, you know? And I'm seeing it from that perspective. I'm thinking, show what you how much effort you put into the theory and the thought behind it. So that's why I'm doing it, but it's still a pain in the ass. It just sucks.
But it's interesting that you say that, because the direction of why you do your, I mean, obviously you do reels and you use social media for the sale, to get people to understand what you're doing and to sell your knives.
Yeah.
Anytime I do, my customer base and your customer base is totally different. Most of my customers are first time knife buyers.
Yeah.
And they're some of them don't. When I do the videos on how to make this stuff, it's just another knife makers. And then they're not. And then the most people who want a knife don't really care. Like I do, every so often I'll do how I do certain things, but most of the time the ones that do better are the ones that are not showing you how to do make things.
Yeah, yeah. No,
forging is always good. Forging is always good. Yeah, hot steel is always good, but like, I find that the less time is better. The more, you know, bang for your buck, the flip things I do, those work pretty good.
Yeah.
But I mean, the best stuff right now has been like a real chef using my knife.
And
that's been to me the best.
And the guy is great. I think he's very captivating in front of the camera. He talks fluently and all that. He, you know.
Well, Bob is really one of the reasons why I like him a lot is because he's not condescending to the viewer.
Yeah.
Like he's not talking down to people. Like there's some of these chefs and they're telling you about, you know, I only use the, you know, this and that, and they're using words that are like very unapproachable. And I like his style. I like his style of just like, anybody can cook, you can do this too. And I just like his style is kind of where I want to be in terms of my knives. I don't fuck around too much with all these buzzwords, and I'm not really. I just want to make a knife you can cook dinner for your family and friends with.
Yeah,
and that's really kind of, and then have a little bit of style on the handle, and I get to fuck around with colors and stuff like that. That's. But other than that, like, it's. How's business? I mean, obviously, I shouldn't even ask you. Business is good for you. You blew through all those 60 knives and nothing. Is other than that, has business been good or?
Yeah, thankfully so. I really can't complain. The demand was very high, and I mean, it put up interesting questions. It's something I actually wanted to talk to you about, because. How would you handle the situation if your knives were more expensive on the aftermarket, you know, sold secondhand, than directly from you?
That's a good question. So, I that's happened to me one time, and years ago, I made a knife with a Food Network friend of mine, Carl Ruiz.
Yeah,
and Carl died. And somebody was trying to sell the knife on the secondary market. I stopped making his knives, and they felt some people felt like that was like some sort of indication of how, you know, limited it is.
Yeah.
So I was selling it at the time. I think we were selling the knives for like $450 or something like that, $460, something like that. I don't remember. It wasn't expensive. And, I mean, that's expensive for a lot of people, but I mean, in the custom knife game, it's not like crazy.
Yeah.
And I remember he sent me a message saying something happened and he wanted to sell it on the black market or aftermarket if I knew anybody. And I was like, I'm not selling it. I'm not going to help the guy sell it. Like, I was slightly, I wasn't like, I mean, I just, go ahead, but I'm not going to like help you.
Yeah, helping is difficult. Helping.
Yeah. You're not the reason why is because he put it up on, somebody sent me a message saying, this guy put your knife on the eBay or something like that, or somewhere for like $2,500, you know, so like more than five times what he paid for it.
Yeah.
And the first thing I thought of is it's not worth it. Like it's not, I'm telling you, I mean, I'm not going to make the knife again, but I'm telling you, whoever pays $2,500 needs their fucking head examined, you know, for this knife that I wasn't even after the fact, like even years later, I don't like it. I mean, in terms of, I would have designed it differently with the experience that I've had now.
No, totally. But that's so, you as a craftsman saying it. You as that craftsman who made it. But I'm thinking there are
two... I was pissed.
Yeah.
I was pissed.
No, I get it.
I was pissed.
There are two ways of thinking of it, because wood under, you know, legal circumstances, without any fraud going on, without the guy misrepresenting the knife, would he have sold it for $2,500? Then, by my definition, it would have been worth that, because otherwise someone wouldn't have bought it, you know?
If somebody want, well, it didn't sell.
Yeah, in that case. But I'm just saying, and hypothetically, then, if it sold for that price, then...
I think that, you know, it gets to the point where I try to, like, stay away from that, steer clear of that shit. And I know that there have been other people who've sold my knives on eBay and stuff like that, and... It's flattering to a certain degree, but it's also kind of like slightly irritating. But you're in a different situation. You and Mareko and like Don Lynn and Nick Anger, and I could list about four other, you know, even Josh Prince. You guys are at a level of like, it's more of a collector's item because you guys don't make as many knives.
Yeah.
And it's not like Florentine kitchen knives. You know, so you have a higher, your reputation and the level that you guys are at, you command a degree of, you know, and deservedly so. So how would I feel about it? I think that I would want nothing to do with it. For my own ego, I would want nothing to do with it.
I mean, I get that sentiment. The question is just, you know, if you, the question I asked myself, and I didn't really encounter that much. You know, I'm in that freak market, in that collector's market. You're right. I think that's a good description. But it didn't happen too often to me that knives sold for a crazy more than I sold them for. But I'm just thinking how to approach it when they do. What you know, what can you learn from that? Because at the end of the day, that's money someone else gets on your shoulders, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult situation, because I mean, the other hand, you raising your prices to that extent isn't the solution either, because then you will lose a lot of customers who bought before. So, but I just wanted to bring that up, because for the listener also to think about, it's a difficult situation. It's not, there is no easy fix, I guess.
Yeah, it's weird, because like, I think to myself, like, let's just say, like, I know that I have something, like, perfect example. Before Uri Hoffe died, he forged, I had a lot of hammers from him, and I wanted him to forge me a hammer, because he used to forge hammers by himself, and then he kind of stopped over the years. And I sent him a message, and he forged me one of the last hammers that he hand forged. He sent it to me. And I thought to myself, I wonder if this is worth something, like now. But at the same time, I was thinking it to myself. But at the same time, it wouldn't be something I'd put up, I'd try to sell, just because it's like, I don't really feel the need to, it's something that I want for forever.
Yeah.
It's weird, because I know that if there was like a very, very, if somebody was to bring to my attention that there were, my knives were selling on a different market and the prices were going crazy, if for a long period of time, I'd probably have to kind of keep that into consideration. But I don't, the way we've done our pricing has been very like specific. And I don't necessarily think that I would do a lot of adjusting based off of what I was getting in secondary market. I'd be pissed off, frankly. I'd be like, I don't want to know about it. Like, there's a lot of shit I don't want to know about. And that's one of them. Like, to the point where the guy who had my knife and he was trying to sell it for $2,500, he was misrepresenting the knife. I mean, he was misrepresenting the knife.
Yeah, that's
bad. He said it was forged, and it wasn't forged. He was giving the wrong measurements. Yeah, all the things he wrote on the description were wrong, to the point where I wasn't going to help this fucking guy. I said, if you're going to sell this, you got to write the right things. And I gave him the right information. I said, you got to change this, because then it is weird for me. Now, the other thing is I also have had a guy bought a knife from someone else of mine, and then he called me the second owner. He called me because he wanted me to fix something on the knife.
Okay.
And I was like, I think it was sharpening the knife or something like that, and I sharpened it for him. But, like, it gets to the point where I don't really want to be fucking around with the second owner.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
No, he never left any money at your company.
It's hard for me in general. Like, if somebody buys a knife from me, it's hard for me. You know, they want something small done. I don't really, you know, send them a bill. It's nothing ever crazy.
Yeah, so I get that. But I know what you mean by the second customer. It's almost like, you know.
Yeah, well, who the fuck are you?
Yeah, yeah. Who, I have no relationship with you.
Yeah, who the fuck are you? What are you talking about? Difficult. You got my knife. I don't give a shit what you got. I also had people who say that they have my knives and they don't have my knives.
Oh, that's interesting.
They have something where they'll talk about, yeah, I have 3 Fader knives, and I'm just like looking, and they show it on their countertop, and I'm like, I didn't make that knife.
How do they have the idea?
They just use the wrong, I mean, they're just, maybe they've been told it was. So, like, I've had that happen. That's weird.
Yeah, that's...
But, look, you know what? There's not one person who doesn't deserve this like you. I don't know if I said that right. You deserve all the success because you're fucking awesome, and you're making great. You're making great inroads. You got that beer you're in the beer scene with Anchorage
Gabe,
Forge.
Yeah, Gabe Fletcher. Yeah,
Gabe Fletcher. How did the beer turn out?
The beer was great. That crazy motherfucker sent me 48 cans.
Oh my god, yeah. That's insane.
he's definitely trying to make me an alcoholic.
Oh my god, you don't need that. Like 48 cans. He sent 48 cans to Germany?
Yeah, to Austria.
Austria? Holy shit. Holy shit.
The same.
Well, do you want to catch it? You want to talk about anything else, or you want to hit a little weird news? What do you want to do?
Yeah, let's do the weird news.
Weird news, guys. We're going to do some weird news. So if you want to follow along with the podcast, I'm going to have all Ben's stuff where in this show notes, but I'm also going to have it at Full Blast Podcast on Instagram. But every so often when I have a couple guys, you know, when somebody's been on a number of times, we like to fuck around with some weird stuff. So I have some weird news. I have some weird news. And what I'll do is I'll read some questions. I'll read some of the titles. And if you want them, we go. If you want to pass, feel free.
Yes.
The first one is wandering monkey blamed for nationwide power outage in Sri Lanka.
Yes, he climbed up the power line.
Did you hear about it?
No, but I know. I am a monkey, so I know what they do.
Well, officials in Sri Lanka said a monkey is in the wrong place at the wrong time was to blame for a power blackout that affected the entire nation. Energy minister something 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 told reporters that the outage was caused by a monkey that came in contact with a grid transformer. The outage began at 11 a.m. Sunday, and officials got to work restoring power with hospitals. Water purification facilities were given proper priority. The blackout evoked memories of some senior engineers said that they've been warning officials for years about the need for upgrades to the power infrastructure.
Yeah, I guess that monkey didn't survive.
When I read this originally, all I could think of is, you're gonna fucking blame a monkey? You're really gonna blame a monkey for this? There wasn't like you didn't have dudes, you know, at these specific places looking for fucking problems. Let the fucking monkey jump on this goddamn thing. You can blame the fucking monkey.
Or build a fence with those, you know, electrical wires, because those fuckers can climb. I mean,
when I originally read this, the first thing I thought of is somebody's passing on blame for their own, you know, their own bullshit. This is a fucking monkey. You know, it should have been like the guy who was watching the power grid went for a shit. and he didn't have someone watching with him. You know, somebody took a nap,
but
or somebody did. I find it very hard to ever accept excuses that are wild like that.
Yeah, but then you have to, if you're the guy who took the shit, then you have to think about some proof. You know, you have to get a roasted chicken or something to present as a monkey or something like that.
Well, it's just like, yeah, I don't know what happened. Maybe a monkey jumped on it. I feel like in society today, even though this is Sri Lanka, and what the hell do I know? I feel as though there is a lot of not taking responsibility for actions and then just giving an excuse like, yeah, well, there weren't anything in place to make sure that monkeys didn't jump on the fucking grid. I just, blaming the monkeys just seems like some fucking bullshit to me, but I'm bitter. I'm bitter about that.
It's a cheap excuse, even if it's true, to be honest.
Oh, so. it's a dumb excuse. And you're going to know people love dumb excuses like that.
Yeah.
I hate excuses. Excuses to me are like, I take responsibility for absolutely everything. And there's just no way that I would just be like, well, not my fault. The monkey jumped on. Get the fuck out of here. Where were you? Why weren't you chasing that monkey away with a goddamn broom or something?
I hate that too.
Something.
I mean, it's almost to the extent where I'm thinking it's childish to, you know, blame someone or something else for your faults. I mean, I don't, not in the monkey case, but I mean in general. I think you should think twice what you could have done differently before blaming anyone or anything. Always. So
I take responsibility for everything in my immediate vicinity that I have anything to do with. Like if I, like in the shop, it's, I take responsibility in that at the, I take responsibility. I would never just like blame something like that. Blame something. I'll never forget. I had this really weird situation happen and I got at the original Center for Metal Arts, the original owner.
Yeah.
He had an affinity for making excuses for things. And at the time of working on this project, it was a giant railing in Connecticut, which is like an hour. The job site was an hour. It was an hour drive to get to the job site.
Okay.
Which is like, there's a lot. And it was a giant job. So we were constantly going over back and forth. It might have even been more than an hour.
Yeah.
But it was a giant amount of time spent, and it was a giant project. I'm sure that they didn't get paid what they should have gotten paid. And I remember going there a lot, and it was at the time when my father was dying of cancer. And I went to go see him pretty much right before he died. And my boss was like, yeah, go see your dad. No problem, no problem, no problem. So we go back to the job site like a couple days later, and the owner of the house came up to me, and I didn't really know her. I was like a workman. I was like laying, you know, lines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the woman came up to me, and she goes, I'm so sorry to hear about your father.
Oh, no.
I don't even know this woman. I'm just like a fucking, and I was like, oh, what do you mean? She's like, oh, I talked to your boss, and he says you're going through it, and that's one of the reasons why things are going along the slower side. And I was like, what the fuck? So I got back to the shop and I said to my boss, I'm like, look, can we just talk for a second? And I said, the woman told me that you was giving me condolences for my father not being well. He got very quiet. I was like, don't fucking bring up my father for why this job is either going slower. I said it in the most positive way. I said, I'd appreciate it if you didn't use my father as an excuse for why a project like this is going, it'll never happen again. That was the end of the conversation. Never brought it up. He walked out of the room. He just, never happened again.
Yeah.
And then, but I was just like, what kind of fucking asshole uses excuses like that because you're not getting it done? I couldn't believe it.
Man.
Like, I was like shell shocked.
Yeah. My ex-boss did a similar thing. I don't know what he used as an excuse, but he used something around me or me myself.
Right.
And he, I confronted him at the time and he tried to justify it before me. Like he just used it as an excuse for the company, for the good of the company. And I shouldn't mind it like that. He tried to justify it. And I'm thinking, what the fuck?
That is mad. I hate it when people make excuses for things.
Yeah.
Like it drives me crazy, especially when knife makers make excuses for why, you know, they take people's money and then they don't make the project. That happens a lot. Like that's the weird thing about this business is because you're creating a craft you're taking a hobby and craft and trying to make a business out of it, and you're trying to figure out ways in which to make money and to do the project. So you'll take a deposit, or you'll take the whole thing and stuff like that. But you got to, part of that is that is the deal that when you take the money, you fucking deliver. And sometimes things happen, but when there are so many knife makers, they make all these goddamn excuses. They'll go online and they'll make a video where they're feeling sorry for themselves and things were bad. Give me excuses and stuff like that. No customer wants to hear an excuse.
No. And
they don't
want to
hear the fucking monkey. And if I was in Sri Lanka and I was like really depending on this power, I don't want to hear be the blame of, oh, well, this monkey jumped on the grid. I'd lose my fucking mind.
No.
I'd lose my mind.
Yeah, totally. I mean, either take that fucking money and make the knives like you do. You're meticulous with that stuff, or you don't take the money. And you know yourself, and you know you can't stick to timelines like I am, and I'm not taking that fucking money because I know I would fuck it up. So, but either way, I think you shouldn't take the money and make excuses. So
take the money, don't make excuses. Yeah. The excuses are like completely unacceptable, and it's just for me personally, it drives me crazy. It drives me totally crazy because I feel as though it's basically what you're saying is you're passing on somebody else's judgment, or you're passing on your own ineptitude on something else. And it's just like, don't give me an excuse. And the other thing is, it would be so much easier just to say you know, something happened and your power will be on shortly.
Yeah.
You don't have to tell everybody everything. Or if you're not finishing the knife, you don't have to give me the song and dance. We got a knife from a guy. He started, and then I gave him money. I think during the pandemic, and I really, really wanted to be, you know, helpful. And I was like, yeah, here's some money. I had some money. I was kind of spreading some money around. And I just remember hearing, you know, I'm like, all right, well, it's been a week. It's been a month. Yeah. It's been another month. It's been a couple months. Where it's 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. And I sent a message like, hey, how's that knife going along? Nobody responded to me. Oh, yeah, I had a setback and I had this health problem here and I'll get this thing and that. And nobody, and all I can think of is, am I going to get this knife or not?
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't want to be like, oh, it's okay. I just wanted to make sure. Oh, don't worry. And it's like, I don't want an excuse.
Yeah.
Just tell me you're working on it. I don't fuck around. It took me a long time to, like, you know, I used to feel as though, oh, they're asking where things are because they're mad. And then my business partner told me, no, they're asking because they're excited.
Yeah, totally.
As long as I don't fucking flake off on people.
Yeah. I mean, you know? And you, the customer doesn't know what you know. You know, you're in that.
Right.
Every day, and you have a certain mindset, and the customer is just excited, just waiting for it. So, I get that. And if you're in a tough spot, then just communicate that directly, offer options, and say sorry, and try to work on a solution. And could be a refund, could be I'm trying to get it out next week. I'm sorry, but don't tell your customers that. Whatever.
Don't guilt trip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it's almost like you're just like you're looking for sympathy. Nobody wants sympathy. They want their product.
I think it's a bad business practice as well, in the sense that it leaves at least in my taste, it leaves a foul taste.
Yeah,
in your mouth, even just as a bystander. You know, even if you're not the one that. Waits on a knife. Even if you just see such a story, you're thinking, well, that looks kind of unprofessional and all that.
I remember the weirdest thing that ever happened to me was I was working on 50 knives. This was when Carl Ruiz was still alive.
Yeah.
And we were working on the Bandito, which was this little version. It was so funny. He wanted a knife for camping and home defense. So it was like so stupid. But I was working on him, and he died while I was halfway on it.
Oh, fuck.
I was working on him, and we sold 50 of them, and I was halfway done all of them, and I got the call that he had died. So the weird thing was, I wasn't really sitting, you know, I wasn't really like I can't finish these knives. I'm too heartbroken. I'm like, I'm not, nothing's stopping. You know, I'm going to work on these knives. And I wrote an email to people who own him. I said, I just want you to know, I just heard this news. I'm devastated. I wrote a whole thing about Carl and what this meant to me.
Yeah.
I said, nothing's changing the deadline. I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm like, nothing has changed. These will still go out on time.
Yeah.
And it was like, I felt though that was just as important as anything else. I didn't make a whole big thing about it. I wrote a whole thing about it, how much more important these knives are, and I'm not making any more versions of his knives. But I was just like, we're gonna go. We got to keep going, you know.
They put the deposit in as well.
Oh, and they paid for the whole fucking thing.
Yeah, not only that. I mean, to be honest. It sounds cold, but from a business point of view, it would be pretty devastating for you as well, I guess. I mean, you put all the work in, then you're blowing it off and paying the money back. And, you know, so it's difficult. I mean, I'm of a quite different opinion as you are on the whole thing anyways. If you're ever making a collaboration with me and I'm dying, I want you to make those knives again and again and, you know, continue my legacy, dude.
Oh, jeez. I would never do it, Ben. I can't do it. You know, that was the thing is when Carl died, I had all the craziest part is when Carl Ruiz died, I had a ton of people reaching out to me because they wanted one because they never got the first chance to get the original Cuban knife. And I was like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
One guy said to me, Carl owed me a lot of money, and I'm hoping that you will fix his debt.
What?
By selling me one of them, that by giving me one of his knives.
Ah, yeah, of course.
Now, and I was like, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm not going to do it. But it was like, I got a ton of people who were like begging, and they were, and I honestly, I felt like, I don't really want to make money off my friend's legacy. Like, it's just like, there's something about it that just, and there were people selling his face on t-shirts and there was a lot of that bullshit.
Nope.
And I was just like, if that's what you want to do, that's your decision. I'm not doing it. We retired his designs the day he died.
Look, there are two sides of it. From your point of view, you're totally right. And I don't know if I would act any different than you, but I'm saying if I was Carlo Ruiz, I'm just telling you, if I'm dying, I would want you to continue it.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, so, Carl would have wanted me to keep going. There's
sorry,
no question.
Carl,
if Carl was alive, he'd have been like, fucking make that money.
Yeah, totally. the money, but you know, having his name out and all that, I think he would just say, yeah, do it.
But you know, at the same time, it's just like, I don't want to be one of these guys. And the other, there's a couple things. Number one is, now, you know, how many years later, like six years later, I don't even like those knives anymore. Like, I'm on to different things.
Yeah,
so, like,
it.
The designs don't really do it for me anymore anyway. So, it's just like, it's not like I'm hanging my hat on this one design.
No.
It was actually an easy thing to get rid of, but, you know. All right. See, this is what I like weird news. So I'm hoping it's going to turn into a conversation. It always usually does with you. Next one is AI-powered death clock can predict when you will die.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Does that sound interesting?
Yeah.
All right, let's go. Okay, so the clock calculates the exact age users will live to and counts down the days, hours, minutes, and seconds until the Grim Reaper arrives. An artificial intelligence-powered, quote, death clock is making headlines after claiming it will predict when the individual may die. The free website called Death Clock Analysis, analyzes personal data such as age, body mass index, diet, exercise level, and smoking habits to predict the date you will die, as well as how you will die. Our advanced life expectancy calculator AI will accurately predict your death date for you, depending on where you live, how much you smoke, and your lifestyle to show your own death clock countdown, the website claims. The clock calculates the exact age users will live to and count down the days, hours, and minutes until the Grim Reaper. Okay. After inputting all the necessary information, the website generates a tombstone with your predicted death date As of the last update, the AI-powered clock has predicted the final days of over 63 million users. I mean, they don't. I mean, the verdict's not out yet. I'm saying the verdict's not out yet. To predict your death date, simply input your date, birth, sex, smoking habits, your BMI, body mass index,
yeah,
and the country you live in. If you don't know your body mass index, simply put the BMI calculator form. The website reads, apart from predicting when the users will die, the death clock often offers tips to lead a longer life. It advises the users to maintain a healthy height, healthy weight, avoid drinking alcoholic beverages, and work out at least 30 minutes a day.
That fucking website was available when I was in school. So I think that death clock website is as old as the fucking internet. And it was way before AI, and it just gave you some funny dates, and it was like rotten.com. When I was young, it was just one of those websites you had to know and had to have seen.
So it's old news bullshit.
No, I think it's just still existing, and now it's jumping onto that AI train and just making new news. Which is, I mean, AI is the biggest bubble there is right now, and you heard it here first from the experts. So
what do you think of AI?
I'm so fascinated that very smart people jump on that train as if it was something amazing, because I'm not a fucking expert, but I think in principle some engineers and coders and some very smart people built something that wants to, you know, act as if it's human and as if it's intelligent, and it does exactly that, but that doesn't mean it's conscious. So some very smart people thinking it's conscious and it will take over, I'm thinking, what the fuck are you talking about? It's like building a wheel and putting it onto a cart and then wondering why it drives. Yeah, of course it will drive. You just built it like that. But it's just, you know, that fucking AI thing does just what you build it for, but that doesn't mean it has any conscious. It tricks you into thinking that. And we humans are so, how do you say it?
Susceptible
to things like that, because we build it, we're smart enough for that, but we can't take ourselves out of it to look at it objectively and think, yeah, well, we build it to trick us, so of course it's tricking us.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is so bizarre. And I actually, when I had Aaron Goff on a couple years ago, he said it's not really AI, it's deep learning software, yeah, which I think is so much more... it's so much more accurate in terms of what AI is, but we've really always wanted it. We've always wanted to use the idea of artificial intelligence. So it's kind of a sexier idea. The funny thing is I have a new iPhone and I have an Apple AI, and what it does is, the cool thing is, you know, there are features that I think are really interesting. Like it does a lot. It's summer. Like I have this new thing where, when I open up my email,
yeah,
it'll summarize, you know, the email based off of, you know, based off of whatever its deep learning software is. But its funny thing is it fucks it all up completely. Like I got a guy from the Culinary Institute of America who refers to Culinary Institute of America as the CIA and he wants to get a knife. And it wrote the quick notes of what it was is it determined that a retired CIA agent wants a knife.
Well, no, that's not really it.
But I was just like, what the fuck? What did he talk? But I think that the biggest problem that AI is going to give us, or artificial intelligence, is it's gonna lose more jobs. People are gonna need. The idea is we're taking away work for a lot of people, and it may be more efficient and cost effective for companies, but there is going to be a growing uneducated workforce is not going to be able to find work, and that frightens me more than anything else.
I mean, yeah, two things. I was going to ask you if you ever tried to use it and if it made sense for you. So that would have been my first question. And in my experience, to most people I talk to, and myself included, every time I tried to use it for anything, it didn't help me at all. It didn't make any sense. So I'm always thinking the way it's advertised as working doesn't match up with the way when I'm using it and experiencing it. And the other thing is, if it theoretically works as advertised or as hyped, I'm thinking it could take jobs away. But usually, I think historically put, we've learned that things like that, like starting from the Industrial Revolution, but you know, going to computers and then smartphones and things like that, the internet, it made us as humans just more efficient. And instead of putting us out of jobs, it just made us putting out more stuff, no matter if it's just intellectual things like, I don't know, creative stuff, books, music, whatever, or actual physical things like, you know, tools or what have you. But I think the potential is there to not cost any jobs, but make us more efficient if it works as advertised. But I'm not sure if it will ever work like that, because right now, and my IT friends who are coding, they tell me the same thing. They tried it to, you know, program things, but they're saying it puts out so messy code that if you're just averagely skilled as a coder, you will be quicker just writing that code yourself and not having to put out all those fires it puts into the code.
But there's still, I see, even today, I see so many jobs that technology and AI have eliminated. And it's just like, I talk about this a lot, toll takers. There are no more toll takers anymore when you're driving down a highway. Yeah. Everything's easy pass or they'll scan your license plate and then they'll send you a bill. All that stuff, like, to me, like, those are jobs gone. Or Ben and I talk about how we hate self-service at supermarkets. Like, all over the United States now, you can do the self-service. And even at Home Depot and Lowe's. And it was meant to have to not have to pay so many people. So jobs were cut because now people can scan their own products. And as Ben says, he's like, you're not paying me to do this job. You can do your, you know, I'm not paying all this money and doing the job. But I mean, I find that, you know, even to the point where, you know, a lot of makers have CNC and then the water jet cut, the laser cut. They don't have a lot of people don't have water jet, but a lot of people have CNC plasma cutters. And even that, to me, I'm just like, I really get any kind of water jet cutting service I do is I have a work with companies that I really like, appreciate. Like I work with the New Jersey Seal Baron and I like working with a company where they are doing this job. And would it be easier for me to do it? Of course. But I'm just like, I also feel as though it's important to have relationships with other businesses. And I feel as though technology is and AI is definitely growing at an exponential rate. I am concerned with when jobs become redundant, what are we going to do to the people who don't have a job? That's always been my biggest concern.
That's a legitimate concern, but I think the jobs that will get lost are jobs like you described. So how do you say it?
Lower educated people.
Yeah, exactly. But I think they, with the help of AI, at least, they will have the potential to upgrade their skills in a way too. So they might be.
I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I don't think AI right now at least works as advertised. In my experience, I tried so many things just spontaneously, just, you know, little things, even the email thing. I tried that as well. And I was never happy with the result. And I'm thinking, what's the hype about if I can't use it as a, you know, normal middle of the line guy who tries to use it? If I can't use it, then it's a bad product, right? In a sense,
I agree.
Yeah,
I use Siri on my phone all the time. I find actually it can be very. I'm getting to the point, and I think it was a lot because I was talking to Tomer Botner. Is so fascinating because he's just like he told me a long time ago. He's like, you got to get you can't be behind the eight ball of the technology. You got to be up with it. So yeah. I really started using Siri a lot, and I like it. I like using Siri a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised at how convenient it can be. Obviously, I don't optimize. I'm not using it all the time. But, like, I am amazed at how convenient it could be. So, I don't know. I don't have any answers. All I know is I get worried. I get worried of, like, at some point, you know, like, here, perfect example, and I know we should hit another question, but, like, when Uber came about in New York City, you couldn't just drive people. You had to have a license and a medallion from the Taxi and Limousine Commission.
Yeah.
And those medallions that were bolted to the hoods of these yellow taxi cabs were a commodity. Like, they were like, you know, each one was like $10,000 to $20,000. Like, if you had this medallion, it was a valuable piece of it was like, it was, there was value to it.
Okay.
And it was a physical medallion that was valuable. And what happened is like, you couldn't, if you could be a, you couldn't illegally drive a car and pick people up. I mean, you had to be, you know. So when Uber came in, all of a sudden, who the fuck is going to hail a cab when you can just get an Uber, number one?
Yeah.
And number two is it completely diminished the price of all these medallions. Like, the medallions weren't anything anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because you don't need to be involved with the Taxi and Limousine Commission to do ride sharing.
But did they regulate it after all? Because that's what happened in Vienna. At first, Uber did come into the market very cheap as well, but then they regulated that to the extent that Uber drivers had to have the same qualification and, you know, be self-employed or employed by a bigger company and all that. And then the prices of Uber, of course, rose up again, and then they weren't a big competition to the taxi drivers anymore.
I don't know the extent of it, but at the same time, I just know that, like, especially in our town, just going under the Facebook pages of the local stuff, the taxi limousine the taxi businesses are getting killed.
Okay.
Because they're just because of Uber and stuff like that. So I don't know. I think that I see AI and, like, technology and all this kind of, like, specialized technology all be. Even just, you know, these new apps and these new opportunities, there are certain people getting opportunities to make money, but then there are also, like, businesses that are going to be having to make major changes.
Yeah, yeah. No, of course. But, yeah.
All right. Well, that was serious.
Yeah.
Let's go to something not so serious. Philadelphia woman's charged after threatening to urinate on a Frontier flight. Let's finish off with this one.
Totally.
What do you say? Congratulations to the Philadelphia Eagles, who won the Super Bowl. The citizens of Philadelphia are burning the fucking town to the ground because they are crazy. A woman from Philadelphia has been charged after she pulled her pants down on a Frontier flight because she allegedly had to use the bathroom. I'm not going to say the person's name. 60 years old, was arrested and charged with interference with flight crew members and attendants. Simple assault in a decent exposure on a Frontier Airlines flight, according to Attorney General something, something, something. According to the affidavit, this person was a passenger on the Frontier flight from Orlando to Philadelphia. Two places I would prefer not to be.
Uh-huh.
Florida and Philly. No offense to Philly, but you got you're a crazy person going from one to the other or the other to the other. During the flight, the affidavit said this person was served two alcoholic drinks. Affidavit said when the plane was about to land at the airport, the flight attendant watched this person get in and out of her seat, claiming she had to use the bathroom. The flight attendant asked this person to stay seated, but this person started yelling and cursing and eventually sat down in her seat. When the plane landed and was taxiing to the gate, the affidavit stated that this person started cursing at passengers around her. The flight attendant called security to help at arrival gate, and the captain asked everyone to remain seated. The affidavit said the plane arrived the gate. The seatbelt sign was turned off. The person continued to be aggressive and pushed passengers out of her way to get in front of the plane to the bathroom, where she was then stopped by a flight attendant. She said, "Sorry, everybody." And then she pulled her pants down and underwear as if she was going to urinate in the aisle. She didn't urinate, but she stood up and put her clothes back on and continued to curse the passengers. This person then attempted to get past the flight attendant where they were trying to disarm the main cabin door, but was unsuccessful, and she continued to yell, curse, and threaten to kill passengers. If convicted, this person could face maximum possible sentence of 21 years and 3 months in prison, 3 years of supervised release, and $355,000 fine.
If she could have pressed something out in front of all those people, I would have been impressed.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you mean just like, just let loose?
Yeah. I think would, like, tense up and would get very embarrassed. So I think it's kind of impressive if you can do that.
When I'm on flights, I'm very conscious of my bathroom use because I do have a very small bladder, and I can be irritated. Like if I know that I've got to go to the bathroom or I'm going to have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So I instinctually do not drink on planes. I don't drink before a plane either because I know that I'm just going to go to the bathroom. And I'm usually dehydrated on the flight in general, so I'm not, like, unreasonable. I also am a big fan of, I like an aisle seat, so I don't have to bother the person next to me to go to the bathroom. Because if I'm not in the aisle seat and I'm in the middle seat, I'm generally going to hold it way longer than I normally would just because I don't want to be a bothersome person.
Yeah. I get that sentiment,
but drinking on a plane, it should be illegal.
I mean, I'm not a big flyer. I flied a few times in my life, not very often, but I was shocked when I heard that you can get pretty drunk on a plane, because I'm thinking, you know, you're a liability then, and you're a potential danger. Where I'm thinking. Yeah, you should. I mean, you should be able to have a beer, maybe, but to be really drunk, that's difficult.
You know, here's the funny thing: Ben Snor loves to drink on the plane. Like he doesn't like to. He's like me; I don't like to fly. So obviously, there's certain people who, you know, obviously, I'm not going to tell Ben Snor he can't have a beer on the plane.
I would use it too.
He's a reasonable guy.
I would use it
reasonable
too.
Reasonable guy.
As a customer, you know, I would use it, but I think, objectively speaking, it's not the best idea.
Yeah, the weirdest part about air travel nowadays, and this is an old joke, but, like, people, I don't know why people fuck around. Like, I don't know why people fuck around the airports. I don't know why people fuck around the planes. It should be a lot more serious than it is. You shouldn't fuck around. If somebody starts making a scene on an airplane, they might have to be restrained.
Yeah. No.
People don't get as nervous as they should on a plane. Like, especially after, I mean, obviously 9/11 was 20 something years ago, but, like, you need, people who go crazy on a plane should be fucking restrained.
Yeah. No, it feels almost like taking a bus to some people, I guess.
Yeah, it's crazy. People wear their pajamas, they don't wear their shoes. They don't. They're relatively impolite. Ah, that's fucking crazy. You know, the cost of flying is so expensive, and the fear of what could happen. I wouldn't put up with that shit at all. But at the same time, I'm also not the guy to turn over to her and say, "Hey, lady, knock it off. No one wants to hear you and your fucking problems."
Yeah. No. Too polite again. I mean, I think I wouldn't fly with my two small kids, just mainly due to politeness, and I mean also because we don't have any necessity. So if we would feel like flying, then we would do it, but I'm thinking, you know, with a 5 and 8 year old, taking a longer flight, that might cause some issues, and I'm just not willing to put up with the stress. But that's mainly stress I'm making myself, so I'm totally in the camp with you with camp politeness.
See, but the funny thing is I'm imagining you, you get your family, you get your two kids and your wife, you're concerned about that, you get them on the plane, and then right next door to you, this woman is like, "I gotta go to the bathroom." Fuck this! Fuck you! I'm going to the bathroom! And you're sitting with your poor kids, and your kids are getting traumatized, and next thing you know, she's pulling her pants down. What are you gonna do, Ben?
Laugh.
You gonna say anything? Oh, you're gonna laugh? You're not gonna, like, defend your kids and say, "Get your goddamn pants on, lady. What do you think this is, Philadelphia? Oh, we're on our way.
And, I'm not worried about my kids in that sense. I mean, she.
I can imagine that if I was in that situation, my wife would turn to me, Jesus Christ, would you do something? I'm like, oh, fuck, what the fuck am I going to do? Madam, we all got it. You just got
to hold. She couldn't come close to my kids. That's something different. But if she pulls her pants down, my kids would laugh as well, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's not worrying yet. But I mean, like if she was a real danger, that's something else. And I don't know how to react in the moment. You know, that's very... Yeah. That's a spontaneous reaction, I guess.
If I was flying by myself, I'd be like, oh, my God, I can't believe we're seeing this. I would laugh about it and stuff like that. But if I was with my wife and kids, my wife and a young daughter, I'd be like, I wouldn't really want to. I'd be like, oh, God, don't make me have to do something. I just don't even know what I would have to. Oh, please, please, please. I would hope that this person would kind of contain themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure they never do.
No, I wouldn't wish for it either.
Ben, we'll never know. We didn't even get through all of them. We were having such a nice conversation.
Yeah, I told you, I'm a blabbermouth, so.
Well, you're not a blabbermouth, you're the best. Guys, Ben Camone. Camone, is it Camone _ knives on Instagram?
Yep.
All right, his link is going to be in the show notes where you ever hear this. Get on Ben's newsletter. I'm on your newsletter, and when it pops up, I'm always looking at it, and I think to myself, oh, God damn it, I want one of these knives. Someday I'm going to do it, but like I got to be flush. I got to be flush with dough. So we'll get there. We're
Don't
gonna
do
get
it.
This so I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get on the secondary market, too. I'm going to get somebody's secondary market, Ben, come on. I'm sure it's going to be like – it's not going to be – all of a sudden, I'm like, Ben, I got one of your knives. But it's spelled Caman. What the
Whoops.
Fuck? And it's going to be a – it'll probably be like a counterfeit Ben Camone knife. That's what you need. You got to get some of them counterfeits.
Yeah, come on.
Guys. Yeah, come on. Come on, knives. Guys, go follow Ben. Give him a support. And, Ben, I love it when you come on. We didn't do enough weird news, but we'll get there next time, okay?
Totally. Save them up. Thanks for having me.
All right, my brother. Oh, it's always a pleasure. You're in that stable of easy ones that it's always fun to talk to you. So I wish you the best of luck, and we'll have you on sooner rather than later, and we'll see you.
Thanks. All the best to you too. Bye.
All right, guys. We're going to see you next week. All the best.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.